This is episode number 20 of The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing. It's hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. And this episode is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. Build and manage your email lists, design killer HTML email campaigns, and send emails with confidence. They just up the limits on their free account. You can store 1,000 subscribers and send 6,000 emails a month. And their new location-based technology gives you the power to send email campaigns that include geo-targeting, locally timed delivery, auto-translation, and more. You can visit MailChimp.com/5x5, and you will get special deals just because you are a listener. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Dan. You know what else MailChimp does?
What is that?
They make Twitter keys.
They do.
Twitter keys is this neat little free thing that just basically sits in your bookmarklets folder, if you, like me, have a bookmarklets folder. And what it does, anytime you want to insert like a heart or a smiley face or a finger pointing or any of the other Unicode...
Right, the little glyphs.
Dingbats. All the little dingbats that you don't know how to encode. You don't need to. You just type them right in and Twitter reproduces them and there you go. And then people wonder what you're doing. Well, what you're doing, you're using the free MailChimp Twitter Keys app that they
Very nice.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Now we all know.
Now we know. Well, we have an amazing guest. Perhaps you can introduce him.
We certainly do. Rich Ziotti is the creator of Readability. He is a founding part, and Readability, of course, for I think everyone listening to this probably knows and probably uses it. It's, speaking of bookmarklets, it is a bookmarklet that removes a lot of the junk from a web page and takes the illegibility out of the web page and makes the web page easy to read and attractive. And there's a bunch of user selectable stuff, does it through CSS, you know, does it with web standards. And he is, in addition, a founding partner of Arc90, which is a consulting firm, a design agency, product shop, and idea incubator based right here where I am in New York City. They have a really good reputation, but not many people have actually seen much of what they do because most of the really brilliant, difficult stuff they do, like most of the solving really tough usability problems, figuring out really, you know, making smooth flows of complex applications, they do that stuff for, I don't know, billionaire bankers or something. I'm not really sure. We'll find out. But they do it for companies that don't want their stuff public. So, you know, you make a little app that five people use and you could be famous on Twitter, but if you make something billionaires use to, I don't know, I don't know what they do, maybe to make sure that no one gets into Fort Knox. Anyway, this is what they do and they're almost nobody's better at it. And Rich has a blog, basement.org, and Rich's company has a thing called their labs. They have Arc90 Labs where, since you can't really see most of their portfolio, they make cool stuff that they just share. And like that, he's trying to undo all my good... well, let's just start right there. Rich, hi.
Hello.
Hello. I want you to defend yourself first. No, we've got out to lunch a few times, and I've told Rich, you know, I'm in a training program. I'm trying to get really healthy. I'm doing weight training, and I'm watching what I eat. So he said, great, let's have lunch. And we had lunch at the best pizza place in Brooklyn, which is, what's the name of that place?
Franny's.
Franny's, right. And the next time we had lunch, where was that?
I think it was in the city, Lombardi's Pizza.
Lombardi's, the best pizza place in Manhattan. Yeah. And then he said, by the way, did you get my mother's package? And what was in your mother's package?
It was baklava.
Right, homemade. your mom is a chef and has a restaurant, and she makes this killer baklava.
So you ate
I had one piece, and it was the best I ever had. And then I gave it to everyone here,
right?
So that I could look like a hero, and I wouldn't eat it because I really wanted to. Because basically, I could have beaten everyone up, taken it home. I could have put on cartoons, gotten naked, and just like smeared the baklava all over my face. But I decided that I want you to die with that visual in mind. But I,
so a regular Friday night for you then, Jeffrey?
Pretty much a Thursday.
Welcome to the show, Richard. How are you?
Thank you. It's great to be here, and thank you for the intro.
Now, listen, I know the way this show usually goes is we usually let the guest talk first, and then Jeffrey comes in with a couple of questions. But I want to supersede that by just saying thank you so much for making Readability. It allows me to use the web again. And thank you for doing that. I don't know what Jeffrey's first question was, but if this goes along with the flow, just start there. Tell me about that. What made you create it? Thank you. But what made you create it? Why is it there? Walk me through this.
Sure. If you hit readability.com, it'll take you to the tool. And it's just the word Readability.
We'll have it all in the show notes. So if you're tuning in later, this will all be there. Don't worry.
Cool. Why did I create it? I read a lot. I read a lot on the web, and I use different tools to read. I use Instapaper to time shift, and it's great for that. And I just found it was just getting harder to read on the web. And what I found myself doing was looking for the print button a lot of the time, which wasn't to print to paper. It was just to sort of get to a little bit of a better experience. I just said, maybe there's a way to find the stuff that I really want to read and cut everything else out and just bring that stuff forward in a consistent experience, in a cleaner experience. So I started messing around. I'm not a coder, I'll admit, and the engineers here at Arc have definitely made the tool a lot better than I could have ever made it. But essentially, I just hacked away in JavaScript and CSS to find the meat of a web page and extract it out and make and present it to the reader. And I created it because you've probably heard this a million times. I just wanted the tool. I wanted it for myself, and I thought it would be an interesting thing to put up on our lab, because I thought it was an interesting experiment. It's actually really hard to get the content worth reading off of a page because every page is different, just about. So the tool came out, and we were just kind of floored by the response. I mean, it just resonated with people in a pretty dramatic way. And it just kind of took off from there. And it's been one of those things we thought we'd just put it out and just get on with our lives, but it kind of won't go away. And now people are using it as a component often in other apps and in other tools and things like that. So it's been kind of crazy.
It's the kind of thing that once you get used to using it, once you put this, and for those who maybe haven't tried it or don't know exactly what Readability is, it's a simple bookmarklet. You put it into your bookmark bar. When you're on a website or a web page that for whatever reason is difficult to read or illegible, or perhaps there's too many advertisements or something, and you just want to get to the content, and you say to yourself, man, I wish this was just black text on a white background and it didn't have all this other stuff. Or like, perfect example of this is my friend and co-host John Gruber, his site, he uses white text on like a slate gray background. And that's his trademark thing. I don't always want to read it like that. I'm getting older. I wear glasses. So wouldn't it be nice if you could just make it black, big black text on a white background? With Readability bookmarklet, you just click this thing. And it does, but you're not limited to that. There's all these like different formatting options you can make
newspaper. Yeah, it looks it's a lot like you preceded it by about a year. It's it looks a lot like what Apple eventually came out with their ebook reader. I mean the kinds of, although I think Readability has more variations and gives the user more control, and you can control the width of the margin. The width of the measure of the column.
Right, Safari basically took this whole hog, Jeffrey, and called it, I think they call it Safari Reader, where it's sort of the functionality is built in. Now, Richard, have you made any money off this thing?
I haven't. No, we haven't made any money off of it.
And it's open source, correct? You just sort of gave it away. You
it's said, correct. Yeah, it's under the Apache. API. Yep. In fact, Apple is using Readability. They actually took our code and built
are
on top
they?
Of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are they?
Yeah. Heard so Apple stole course. From us. So that's kind of cool to say.
We're not going to say stole.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
We're going to say that because it isn't stealing. You gave it away. Yeah. You said, here it is. Like they said, we need a browser.
Exactly.
Oh, here's an open source browser. It's called WebKit. Let's use that. So they took something that you made and gave away open source.
Right.
And in inimitable fashion, they began competing with you.
Exactly. I mean, you know, leave it to Apple. Can't come up with a creative idea on their own to steal ours and put it into their browser. It's cool. It's
that.
Great.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
I just don't want you to say that. I like Apple.
No, I'm kidding, obviously.
I know.
Don't get emotional now, Jeffrey.
Okay. Okay. It's all right. Okay.
So do you think that this particular project that you did, Readability, is the one that people know you guys most for creating, or has it helped you? And again, Jeffrey said at the top of the show, you know, you're doing stuff that's behind the scenes a lot. And that was always something that back in the days when I used to do software development and consulting, especially on the software development side. You know, you might have a big website that launches, and then all the designers are opening, you know, champagne in there.
Yeah.
You know, they're toasting each other's great successes on their yachts, and all the developers are in the back room thinking, oh man, we've got to tweak the database again, and
right.
And it's so hard to get a lot of this stuff that you do behind the scenes or that you do for companies. That you're not allowed to show. You're designing what we used to call intranet applications or things like that.
Is that correct? Have we stated it correctly? You're designing mostly intranet applications, or are they public? But how does that work?
Well, it depends. It has depended on the client. Some of the stuff we create is higher profile. It's public facing. Some of it is internal tools. I guess you could say intranet, but they're typically more complex than that. Some of it is to a population, for example, agents or analysts that are insurance agents that are hitting a particular piece of software that's been created by one of our clients. So it kind of varies, but yes, I mean, to answer your question, most of our work isn't sort of mainstream pop type of apps. I mean, Readability probably has provided us with the most exposure in terms of beyond the circles within which we do business typically.
Okay, so would it be fair to characterize you as somewhat like 37 Signals, only secret, or is that not fair? We're big fans of 37 Signals. They're friends of ours. Mm-hmm. We've had Jason Fried on the show.
Sure.
But what you do gets compared to what they do, doesn't it? Or you do it the same kind of thing only for a.
That's a good question. No? I've never heard us get publicly compared. I mean, I think there are similarities.
Well,
which is enough. I mean, I think there are some similarities. I think the key distinction is they're just about everything they produce. I don't think they do consulting work anymore. I think they're a pure product company at this point. And
correct.
All their apps are effectively public-facing, sign up, put in your credit card, and you're good to go. I think for us, none of our apps are like that. We do have a product, but it's not – you can't just pull out your credit card and purchase it. It's a product that gets implemented within your company or organization and such. I think one of the things that's similar
Back up. What is that product?
Yes. It's a product called Kindling. Actually, it's at kindlingapp.com. That's public. There's nothing secret about that project. It's essentially an idea sharing tool, and it's really thoughtfully designed, really well put together. It actually came out of an idea within the company. We didn't sit down and say let's create an innovation social tool. for companies. One of our developers here is actually a partner now at Arc 90 named Chris Derry. Actually, I think it was on a couple of weekends, said, you know, I want a good way to share the ideas that that circulate within Arc 90. And he built this tool. And it was really cool, and we used it, and we used it for a little while, and said, you know, this is something that that could probably be a product. And we got Chris really drunk, made him sign away his rights to it, and productized it. And today, you know, we're seeing great traction. I mean, a lot of interest in the product. And I think the crux of it for us is I think we're a product company. I think we do work for other clients. But we really are product strategists, product marketers, and designers that build product end to end. We're really not very good if you're going to bring us in and put us in on an assembly line, like clean up this database or
right.
You know, we're not that type of shop. So,
are you the type of shop? So, when you do client services work, mm-hmm. are you the type of shop where I would say I have this great idea? I've some demos, but I really don't know how to execute it. I want to take it to mm-hmm. the next level. I've got X dollar budget. Mm-hmm. And you would come in and say, all right, well, we're not owners. It's not our product. We're not going to monetize it for ourselves, but we're going to charge you to make a product that you can use that does what you say. Is that a fair characterization of work that you might do for a Leapfrog or a Semantic or
exactly
an IBM?
Yep. If you've fully fleshed out the vision around your product and you think you've solved all the puzzles around it and the market and pegged the market and just need a contractor to build it, meaning you've got the blueprints, we can do that. But really where we're most effective is where you're still at a higher altitude and you still haven't fully thought it through, and you're still you think you've got something really powerful, or you think you've got a market pegged, and you want to flesh out the ideas and the thoughts and really nail down a strategy, then that's where we shine. In that we'll challenge you, we'll actually try to punch holes in it and really talk through, and then we'll take it further.
I want an application for people who love to read books, who are lonely and want to meet someone else who reads books, who likes the same books they do. And that's my idea. And I would come to you and you do market analysis, strategy. By the way, is that a good product idea?
It sounded a little sad.
It did sound sad.
Something about loneliness and books. And
well, books are nice.
Books are nice. Books are nice. I think that is a typical case. And sometimes they're ventures or they're initiatives within bigger companies who are trying something new. Sometimes they're startups that want us to help them flesh out and design and think through and define product and build it. I think another characteristic that makes us a little unique is we'll design and we'll build.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, having the expertise you have, being in New York, you must get a lot from startups who really can't afford you.
Mm-hmm.
And what with HappyCog, one stream of business that we sometimes have to turn away is the startup with a really interesting idea, but no budget.
Yeah.
And they want to own everything. So they're sort of like, well, we have this great idea, so it kind of behooves you to build it for us. And how do you typically handle situations like that? Or is there a typical?
Yeah, it's happened, no doubt. Typically, it's tough for us to buy into that, mainly because we've pushed our own product initiatives. And when you push, we've taken on a lot of risk ourselves between Kindling and other ideas that we have. It's really tough to wedge in and say, yeah, I'll do this in lieu of some future equity or something like that. It's kind of tough to take in. I still have a never say never mindset. I mean, if someone is willing to share their vision or their idea and we really fall in love with it, absolutely. But, you know, that's a balance, I guess, you have to strike, because you could get trapped, right, very easily. I mean,
Right.
There are a lot of ideas are kind of easy. Executing on them is the really, really costly, difficult part.
I think probably everyone in, as an example, almost everyone in our business has surely at some point wished for a tool like 37 Signals Basecamp, but 37 Signals created it.
Exactly. Right?
And they keep working at it. Let me ask you another question, not to stay on 37 Signals, but 37 Signals are self-designers. That is their design process. They design the kind of app that they would want, and then they find customers who want that app as well, and there's lots of customers like them. They sort of, they don't do what, you know, the more traditional user experience consultancy thing where you say, all right, we're going to spend 6 months analyzing your users, and we're going to do some market research and look at your market. Okay. So now you work with large corporations. You see where my question is coming. How does your process compare? I know that if you designed Readability because you wanted that product, you designed Kindling because it was like, wow, this would be a great product for us. But with client work, what do you do? Do you make what you think would work best, like the 37 Signals method, the sort of iterate often and make something you think is cool, or do you do traditional?
Well, you know, fortunately, we've been really fortunate in that we've been around for 6 years and we've had three or four major clients. And what that leads to is it's not very self-contained project-based work. It's longer-term strategic. We almost become our clients to a large extent. We really we internalize and understand their business to such an extent that you know, the conversations and the brainstorming and the thinking that goes on is very much collaborative. And that's, I think, that plays to one of our strengths, which is we're not good at churning through proposal after proposal and doing work that that is relatively commoditized. I mean, the truth is we're a dev shop in Midtown Manhattan. And, you know, if you need a CMS implemented, we're probably not going to be the place to go, right? And so for us, those deeper strategic relationships are really what it's all about. I feel like I didn't answer your question.
No, it was a really interesting topic, new topic.
Yeah.
But
I think...
Let's ask it another way. Talk us through your design process. You get your assigned design process. Sorry. So Hewlett Packard comes to you and says, we need a product for our engineers to communicate with our customers. Terrible product idea. What's your process? Do you just smoke a bunch of pot and then see what happens, or
some of us do. I'm not gonna. Well, maybe we should highlight the names of the people at ARC who do that. it's ideally, and you know, you obviously can't control the dialogue of every conversation. Ideally, we can sit down and they don't have a lot of preconceived notions of what they want. They know the problem they're trying to solve or the thing or sort of the goal line they want to get to. And what we'll do is, and I don't even know if you'd call this design. It's really just talking and understanding where they're looking to go and then sort of synthesizing that with our own understanding of what technology can do. And saying, you know, did you know you could approach it this way, and this might be interesting, and this might be, really innovative, a really innovative approach to take. And that, you know, being able to have those conversations, I we call them strategy sessions, and I that's such a broad term, but really what they are saying, you know, we're gonna sketch for a little while and really think through. The pros and cons and weigh, you know, let's stay at the concept level. And then as things start to firm up, we sort of descend in altitude, right? And start to come up with more and more definition. One of the ways I like to explain who we are, and one of our biggest problems is it takes like 20 minutes to explain who we are. That's a bad thing, right? They say you should be able to explain yourself, you know, in 2 minutes or whatever. One of the good ways to explain, I think one of the more effective ways to explain who we are is, you know, you can go to some of the bigger sort of management consulting firms, and they'll do an analysis of your business, and then they'll, their artifact, the thing they typically leave behind is the slide deck or a binder of sort of recommendations.
Right.
And that's effective, right? I mean, they're smart people, and they're digging into your world, and they're giving you guidance. The thing,
the more you pay, the smaller the paper they leave behind. So that's when you're when you're paying a whole lot of money, they'll give you like a page with three bullet points on it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And I think the distinction for us is we keep going. We say, okay, you know what? We've gotten to a good place, and now what we want to do is prototype. We want to build sort of a small scale model of what we're envisioning. And now the design process is almost a natural progression. It's almost a natural descent into what will hopefully materialize into actual product. And I think that's what's unique about us is that we keep going. We don't just leave you with a slide deck.
It gets tricky too when you're making HTML prototypes for something that really is only going to work when you built the back end.
Mm-hmm.
Is tough too, because you can make these sort of, you can't do the typical testing where you say, okay, buy a chair. The person, the person who's using the product can't buy the chair because there is no database, there is no back end. So you're like, pretend you're buying a chair. And it's
right.
I mean, I always find that part of it hard, doing testing that's real before you spend $1 million building something.
Right.
What are your,
Yeah, what we do, and this is one of the benefits of having strong technical skills in the same shop is we go much further than the typical static prototype. We'll actually go ahead and wire together and build what won't be necessarily a final production version of the app, but we'll actually make it work. We'll actually build a dummy data back end. We want it to feel exactly like the app is going to feel. In fact, with one of our clients, we actually went ahead and they were a specialized search engine, and they wanted to really reimagine the end user experience. So what we actually did was we built a proxy tool that actually took the content off their existing search engine and pumped it into the new experience. So it was almost like we hacked the hell out of our client's existing app just to really convey this new experience in a very realistic way. And we'll actually go to great lengths to do that. We believe in creating a really realistic experience around what we're envisioning.
And so that wasn't Bing and that wasn't Mahalo. Who was that?
It was a search engine for engineers called Novel. Yeah. It's
Novel.
A specialized. Yeah. With a K.
I've got a question for you, Richard.
Sure.
I'm hearing you describe this really awesome process that you have. And, before the show started, I was looking at your people page. It looks like you've got something like 30 developers or not developers, 30 people on your staff, many of whom are developers, designers, strategists, everything. When you started out, though, you probably weren't 30 people. And I'm really curious to know, there have to be people listening to the show right now who are thinking, man, if I could just get out from under this 60-hour-a-week job or this consulting load that I have, and how do these guys get to where you are now? So that's my question. How do people follow down this path? And maybe you can talk a little about what your journey has been like.
Yeah, I mean, I was essentially doing sort of independent, kind of mercenary consulting work. I wasn't really working for anyone for a couple of years. I was a .com poster child. One of the companies I was at imploded spectacularly, and I kind of drifted around a bit and did consulting work. And I mean, to be frank, I an opportunity came along, and it was just through an older relationship, and I just took the plunge. I could have just taken that opportunity and done more consulting work. And I said, I thought it was an interesting time. This was around 2004, and the web was starting to be reimagined from a place where you publish pages into a platform, right? And a place where, the web, this new perspective was coming, was taking hold. And I said, maybe this is a good time to do it. And I wish I could tell you there's a magic formula. I pretty much just ate into all my savings and bought chairs and desks. And we started off as three people. It wasn't like I took this insane risk. And it just sort of went organically from there. I think that's the crux of it, is you have to just decide to take that leap. And it's scary. It's a little frightening to say, all right, it's not me anymore. It's this other thing. And it's this other brand. Because before that, as an independent consultant, it was pretty much, hey, Rich does pretty good work. You should get in touch with him. That was the gist of the brand, right? And the work that's happened over the last 5-6 years is really getting out of the way of that. And, you know, now it's this incredible group of people that's a lot smarter than I am that have made the brand what it is today. It's really kind of taken on its own identity and personality. So, I think it's just that, you know, you're taking that step forward, and right. It's a scary step, and then you kind of grow from there.
There's something that I hear you saying throughout this entire talk that we've been having today, and it sounds like you genuinely enjoy doing the kind of client work and working with customers. And so often I hear stories and you know, we mentioned 37 Signals, we'll mention it again, where it seems like the minute that they can stop doing client work, they do, oh, well, we've got a product now, so we're done with client work now. We're just doing this. Why didn't you guys take that approach? Why do you continue to do that? Is it, what's the difference?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. Two reasons. Well, first off, to be clear, we hate all of our clients. I'm kidding, obviously. Mainly, they pay us a lot of money. I mean, to be blunt, the relationships we have are, and you know, it isn't only about money. It's that the type of relationship they've taken the plunge and agreed to have with us, and to have that kind of relationship, and it's really very much a partnership. In almost all the cases, it is a partnership. They expect pushback from us. They expect us to challenge what they put forward. And when you have that kind of dynamic, it's really, really different. It's a very different experience from having a do as you're told and thanks for your feedback, but
make,
it's going
make
in the
trash.
Make the
logo bigger.
Exactly. And we've been really fortunate and probably subconsciously selective of the types of relationships that we took on, and that's just something we've been fortunate to have.
It's not just good luck. I mean, we do that too. I think it's a very deliberate. Just like you pick who's going to work with you and how quickly you're going to grow. I think you pick clients you can believe in that you can kind of that you say we, you know, it may not always be fun. There may be some friction, but it'll be good creative friction. It won't be disrespectful friction, and you just know that.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
It's really a relationship, like a real friendship.
Yeah, especially if it's going on for 2 years, 3 years. Yeah. I mean, it is a relationship. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So when you're starting out, though, so often you're having to take these, you know, $1,500 projects. You know, we need one page with a, you know, some basic, you know, they don't know how to do simple things, and they basically want to move your hands for you and have you write and create something that's exactly, you know, exactly the way they want it, or you're dealing with customers or clients that are difficult. How do you get to that point where you are comfortable enough to say no to a customer, no to a client? When you're sitting in that meeting and you're like, man, I know this project is going to suck. Yeah. I've got that bill to pay.
Yeah.
You know, how do you find yourself no longer in that situation? Is there a recipe? Is there some magic, something you can do, or just a lot of hard work and a lot of patience?
You know, I think it's one of those self-fulfilling things. I think we've gotten to a point now, and I think the sort of tone that's set when we have those initial meetings, you can kind of tell. We pretty clearly send the signal across of the type of relationships that are going to work best with us. And I think it's sort of a self-reinforcing thing. You know, in terms of a magic formula, I mean, there is no magic formula. I think the way we've been fortunate is that the relationships we have had have been long-term. So we don't we don't really do the RFP proposal process. I mean, that sounds obnoxious and maybe elitist and such, but we really don't do it. Like our relationships today, the most significant relationships we've had, started over coffee or started off of a spirited discussion about something someone's envisioning, whether it be that prospective client or us. And I think when you start on that basis versus I just got an RFP in the mail, it's just right there. The tone is very different.
Yes.
Jeffrey, you probably, I'm sure this probably echoes some of your experience, I'm guessing.
Well, I've regretted when I haven't listened to that voice that says you can get along with this person. Only a couple of times. We've been very fortunate, but it is, I mean, yeah, it's relationships and it's a sense of people. And for us, it's like being willing to be broke sometimes, even if necessary, like to being willing to worry about money every once in a while, not that you want to, rather than harness yourself into something you're going to hate, the client will hate, and, you know, they're definitely...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's you just hit it. I mean, it isn't easy. I mean, it isn't easy for a company like ours that's, you know, pretty much grew organically, never really got funding or anything like that, to pass on work, right? But if you can foresee this is going to be a slow motion train wreck, no one's going to come out feeling good, right? We're going to look a little worse. They're not going to speak well of us. They're going to be unhappy. So I think but that's not easy to do, right? Because there's, you know, you got to keep the lights on. And so you have to weigh that. You have to be very careful about that. It takes a lot of discipline, I guess is maybe a good way to put it, to know that it's the wrong type of relationship.
Yeah. Let me ask you something else that you probably won't want to answer. But so we started with readability, and we know that to date you haven't earned any money with readability. But I wonder if there might be something on the horizon for readability that our listeners could be the first to hear about.
God, I love you so much, Jeffrey. I mean, we're doing something really, really interesting / groundbreaking / potentially suicidal with readability. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. It's not far away. It's probably within the next month or two, we'll be announcing it. It's not ready yet. I will say this, a couple of things. One is we're actually going to be collaborating with Instapaper, with Marco Arment.
Yeah, okay.
We're excited about that, really excited about that. And the other is that, you know, a lot of people kind of pigeonholed readability as the ad stripping tool. And if you follow our writing on our blog and our talks and such, we actually care quite a bit about writers and content creators. And in fact, you know, if you really look at the tool, it actually comes out of a love for the content. The tool came into existence because I really appreciate it, and I think for a lot of people that it resonated with, really appreciate the content and really want to believe that the content deserves better. So in the next, you know, really soon, we're going to be announcing a really interesting initiative around readability
and content.
Yeah, and content creators and publishers and writers.
Like newspaper publishers or book,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, anyone that's creating content. And you know, these are obviously interesting times in it's sort of a crossroads today in terms of, well, look what the web is doing to everything and you know, the iPad. I'll tell you what we don't think is going to work. I mean, I don't think the iPad's going to save everybody. I mean, the paywall story, I think, is kind of playing itself out in terms of, you know, slowing down the web and slowing down the power and the shareability of the web. So is there a way to provide a platform where the web isn't slowed down, but we recognize and acknowledge and work with content creators and writers? Is that cryptic enough for you?
Yeah, I was going to say, I almost feel like you told me something.
I think I told you less.
Yeah,
I think you knew more before I said anything.
Yeah. I think it will be very interesting to see what readability and what was the name of that other? Oh yeah, Instapaper. I think what readability and Instapaper.
We're merging the two, and we're going to call the new company Instability. What do you think? Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, Marco is going to kill me for that joke.
That's your brother? No, that's Instapaper guy.
Yeah, he's the guy that created Instapaper.
Yeah, of course.
Correct. Smart guy.
Should have him ask him to see if he could be on the show too.
He finally, for those who don't know Marco recently, he was, I'm not sure his actual position at Tumblr, but he was a developer at Tumblr in some capacity, and just announced that he was leaving Tumblr to pursue doing Instapaper full time. So he said, I wonder if it is. And he said that as a result of that, I've been inviting him to these shows for quite a while, and he couldn't because he's, he's been full time with Tumblr, and now he has time opening up. So we definitely will try and get him on some of these shows.
Also, we've tried to get people from Apple to speak at our conference, and sometimes they'll even. They'll get permission from 12 people, and then the day before the show, they have to cancel because Steve wasn't happy.
I think they actually remove their vocal cords. I'm not sure.
They put them back when they fire them, though.
All right,
so
guys.
We're going to have to go.
Yeah,
we've
got to wrap.
This has been absolutely fantastic, and I can't wait to have chocolate cheesecake with you at our next...
I'm going to send you some rice cakes, Jeffrey. Some
rice cakes?
Dried
papaya.
We're
good. We're good. We'll keep doing the other thing.
And the baklava is from samsbakery.com. My mom's going to kill me if I don't plug it right now.
Yes. Samsbakery.com.
Yeah. Queens or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn. Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
Yeah, Sam's but you can Bakery. Order online if you're anywhere you are. So.
Rich, if people want to follow you or learn more about you, where should they go?
Well, Arc90, the blog at Arc90, blog.arc90.com, and our lab.arc90.com is where all of our lab experiments are. And me personally, it's Rich Ziadi, RICHZIADE on Twitter.
And basement.org.
Basement.org.
Basement.org is, yes, my personal blog. True.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much, Richard, for being our guest today. It was quite a pleasure to have you on the show and to learn everything that you could share with us. Thank you for doing that, Jeffrey. As always, thanks so much for being here today.
Pleasure, and I will see you. When are we doing our next show, Dan?
We're doing it a different day, a different time, because I've got some things going on later next week, and Jeffrey and I have been talking for a while about doing a different kind of Big Web show, a special episode. And that's going to be next week. Aren't we doing it at 2 p.m. on Monday, I believe, right?
I think that's right. We'll have to look at the Twitters and see.
Yeah, we'll have to check it out. Twitter knows. Twitter has the answers.
Twitter knows.
But we're doing a special show at a special time, so tune in next time. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Go check out MailChimp.com/5x5 for the special deals that I told you about before. And we'll see y'all again next week. Have a good one.
Peace.